Yes, so first of all, I can thank the organizers for being patient with me and choosing the bus a little bit so that I can actually make it. I was kind of straight from the airport, actually. So I know it's Friday afternoon and everybody's probably very tired, particularly me. My talk will be maybe a little bit more general and will focus on certain, I think, quite interesting and unique, certain unique aspects of graphene that have to do with the role of zero energy states in basically catalyzing whatever orders graphene can support. So most of what I will be talking about has been done in collaboration with my student Ethan Roy and postdoc Vladimir Juricic and colleague Oscar Vafek at Florida State. So, of course, there is no need to talk too much about what graphene is.
There should be a laser printer if you want, a laser pointer if you want.
Oh, thank you.
No, right here, the one that looks like the pen.
Uh-huh. Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So, of course, just to remind a little bit, one probably the simplest way to think about graphene has been actually pointed out by a Canadian physicist Wallace a very long time ago. And you can think about it as basically electrons hopping on a bipartite lattice, like honeycomb lattice. And if you just take the nearest neighbor hopping into account, which is actually a pretty good approximation, you immediately discover that there is one unique feature to graphene, and that is that this matrix element that we usually encounter in the tight binding calculations in graphene actually is a convex sum. And since there are, of course, two components to the wave vector, there are two conditions for the states which are precisely at Fermi energy, if it is at zero energy, let's say, and two conditions for two variables, of course, lead generically to points and not to Fermi surface that we are used to. So this, of course, is exactly what makes graphene interesting for all us. But actually, instead of having to deal with a Fermi surface, we have just Dirac points. And that, in fact, makes the system, in a certain sense, simpler, but in some other aspects, actually much more interesting than if you're used to. So if you look at the Brillouin zone, for example, these Dirac points lie on these corners of this hexagon. And of course, not all of them are equivalent. Only two are inequivalent. I can choose, for example, I and L here. And around each one of these, of course, the Dirac column is actually isotropic. One can show that to be generally true, even in the presence of interactions, as long as the symmetry of the original hexagon lattice is observed by the ground state and low energy stations. And one can therefore group these excitations near, let's say, these two points into one beautiful four-component object like this, which we call Dirac fermion. And let me call U and V excitations, creation operators at the two sublattices on the honeycomb lattice. And then I have U and V around K point, let's say, and U and V around minus K point. If I can put them all together for each spin, I'll actually end up with a four component object like this. If I have spin 1/2, of course, as we do for electrons, essentially we have two four component Dirac fermions in the game, which in a certain sense actually makes graphene a little bit mean-killish. That in fact there are lots of fermionic components. So typical calculational schemes that rely on n, where n is the number of components being large, being indeed large, in graphene actually are not such a bad approximation after all. So this being the case, what we typically do is to actually focus on the low-lying excitations around these two special points, and therefore write down the simple linearized Hamiltonian, which I here also wrote in presence of the magnetic field that I was talking about a lot. So in doing so, of course, we encounter actually some matrices, because these will obviously be a four-dimensional matrix operator, if you will. And therefore, there will be some matrices appearing, and depending which is your favorite coordinate frame or representation, there will be different matrices involved, but of course, they all satisfy the commutation relations of this. Now, one thing to notice immediately is that, of course, we all know graphene is a two-dimensional system. And what that means is that, in fact, when I construct this Hamiltonian, actually, I will be using only three matrices. For example, gamma 3, which the different one uses, in the equation in field theory actually is not used here. So this simple observation actually will have some consequences. Well, how do we know that we have these Dirac premiums? Just to remind you, one of early ways to tell how to how that you indeed have Dirac premiums in spectrum is through actually Landau quantization. So Landau quantization here works slightly differently than in the case of just the Schrödinger equation in the field. First important difference is, of course, that Dirac equation allows positive and negative states. So therefore, there will be negative Landau levels, positive Landau levels, and most particularly, this Landau level with zero energy that I will be talking about a little bit more later. And furthermore, because of this additional degeneracy, from there are two Dirac points involved, actually there is additional factor of two in the degeneracy of each of these Landau levels that actually is this valley degeneracy. So therefore, if we encounter, if we for spin as well, each Landau level is four times more degenerate than the ordinary Landau levels would be. In fact, one sees that in let's say, in an ideal situation without any disorderly interactions, this would be seen as jumps of four in the whole connectivity in the units of ordinary, of usual whole connectivity. And this is precisely what has been seen.
But hold on for a second. You are not claiming that is necessary, but that's not sufficient. I mean, that happens in silicon inversion layer also.
Yes.
You can have very trivial reason to have four. So that's I don't see any profound thing in saying four. I mean, I hope we agree, right? I mean that's
yeah. Then I'm very profound. Yeah. That's right. But this was historically actually one of the ways that people thought it. Okay,
All I'm saying is in a pure Schrodinger equation, if you had a semiconductor valley degeneracy, then you'll see four also. This has nothing to do with that theory. Okay. That'll be a four component, that'll be an SU4 model.
That's right. In case of graphene, the significance of this result was that this was a way to tell whether you have just one layer.
Absolutely.
Two or three or
sure.
Four layers.
Sure.
That was the only significance. So the others are completely. So this was one of the later actual experiments that looked at hollow quantization in graphene, and for instance, if you look at this blue curve, you can see this somewhat wibbly steps here at 2, 6, 10, and minus 2, minus 6, and so on. Actually, higher fields, there is more structure, and I'll be coming to that a little bit later. So, this is all well known, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. So, One thing that, of course, we all like a lot in the Dirac equation is that actually has plenty of symmetry. And now some of the symmetry is exact symmetry, and some of it is actually emergent, if you like, which is just a fancy way of saying that basically this comes out after you linearize your Hamiltonian. Of course, you are allowed to linearize it because if you look at excitations at room temperature, actually this is an excellent approximation. So one such symmetry is Lorentz symmetry. And of course, with microscopic, you want to keep in mind that in writing, actually, in the acting theory of the Dirac electrons, the only symmetry that is really present is the one where you would exchange the sublattices A and B and exchange the Dirac points. And altogether, this is just a very small symmetry group, the Hilbert group. But in fact, if you linearize, first of all, you get full rotational symmetry, and furthermore, even you can rotate in the imaginary time direction, and therefore Lorentz symmetry. This is one very useful symmetry that one can exploit, for example, to study situations in which you would have crossed magnetic field and electric field. You can actually do a Lorentz transformation into a frame where you would have a pure magnetic field. And solve otherwise complicated problems by very simple transformations. I will not talk too much about this symmetry, but I will talk a little bit more about what I would call a chaos symmetry, or some people like to call a valley squirrel, I don't get it on this on the pointer, valley pseudo-spin symmetry. And this is really generated by these gamma matrices that we have not used in the construction that I've done. Oh, thanks. You see. Thank you very much. Okay, this one is a little stronger. So for instance, since the Dirac equation looks very much like the equation for a neutrino. Of course, you'll remember that gamma 5 anti-commutes with all gamma matrices and therefore commutes with the products of two gamma matrices, which is what we have in the Hamiltonian. So therefore, gamma 5 generates what one DDT calls chiral symmetric eigenvectors. Here, exactly the same role is played by gamma 3, which has not been used in the construction Hamiltonian. And therefore, their product, which I like to call gamma 35, is actually also symmetric. And therefore, they close the group, which is as you do, for each spin component. So this is not a real spin symmetry. It's actually a merging symmetry that comes from linearization of the Hamiltonian. Of course, there is another exact symmetry, which is, of course, time reversal, if it is present, if there is no magnetic field, for instance. And one can, of course, write down some anti-unitary operator for it. That's an exact symmetry. But most interesting, at least to me, Dirac equation also allows a set of what you could call supersymmetries, or basically particle hole symmetries. And these are the operators that do not commute, but anti-commute with the Dirac Hamiltonian. So they actually play an interesting role in several aspects of physics of interactions in their field. So which are they? We can simply number them because we know the algebra of four-dimensional matrices. And for the purpose of the talk, you will excuse me, but I will mostly neglect spin altogether. And that just complicates it a little bit, but it doesn't have anything essential. So one such matrix that anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian that I wrote before is gamma naught. But there are more. There is also gamma naught gamma 3 and gamma naught gamma 5. And I had this I here just because this is the way to actually have everything Hermitian. That's not very important. And also, there is another operator that I can write, which is the product of gamma 1 and gamma 2. Now, you see, interesting thing about this matrices is that if you act with any of these onto some state of the Hamiltonian which has certain energy, you will actually generate up to a phase factor state which has the negative energy. So this one has E, this one will have minus. So basically it maps positive energy states, particle states onto Hall states. So you can immediately say that, well, if there are any states which have precisely zero energy, and you'll see that those actually generically merge in magnetic-like fields, these will, in fact, be invariant, that Hilbert space will be invariant under the action of all of these supersymmetries, if you want to call them that way, just to distinguish them from ordinary symmetries. So what do these represent, you see? These actually, if you would add them by hand to the Hamiltonian, would in fact be a relativistic mass, or a gap. Right? So we see that we actually have two different types of possible gaps in graphene. One is any linear combination of these first three that I introduced, for example, just gamma naught, or any linear combination of these three. That would, in fact, break chiral symmetry, as one can easily check simply by algebra of these matrices, but would, in fact, preserve time reversal. That is one way to introduce the gap. And another, and the only other algebraically allowed way of introducing the gap, is by actually adding simply this remaining M tilde mass, which is simple product of gamma 1 and gamma 2, that also undercommutes with the Hamiltonian, and therefore also gives me a nice relativistic mass. So in either case, the spectrum becomes gapped. But in the second case, actually, the chiral symmetry is preserved, but one can show, in fact, just for simply algebraic considerations, that time reversal symmetry is then necessarily broken. And you will see, actually, that this is something that you will recognize from. So what I'm saying is that you can add this by hand or modify your Hamiltonian in a certain way so that these actually come out. So what do these mean first, before we talk a little bit about how they can arise? What do they physically mean for the lattice? Well, the gamma naught, for example, depending on which representation one works, utility be something which is like a staggered density. We want to call it charge density wave. Of course, this doesn't quite break the translational symmetry of the lattice, but I would prefer like, to call it staggered density, in fact. So this is something that would have actually more, on average, electrons on one sublattice than on the other, although the overall pin is still zero, not one electron per sub. So that's a familiar state. If, of course, I allow for spin, then, of course, I can have the sense of this staggered density different for two spin species, and I may end up actually with a nail over there, way better in that case. So this actually preserves translations, obviously, of the lattice, and, of course, preserves time reversal. Now, this M tilde component, however, this fourth mass that I mentioned, is a little bit more elaborate and actually has been known for quite a while due to Duncan Haldane, who showed that, in fact, if you would, by hand, let's say, introduce hoppings on a lattice, on a canonical lattice, so that you have, let's say, hoppings in this sense with, let's say, hopping element I times the hopping element between nearest neighbors, and then on the other sublattice in the opposite sense also, so therefore minus I on the other sublattice, you can actually show that once you have diagonalized that, that single particle Hamiltonian, you will end up actually with a gap for the otherwise Laplacian fermions. And you will break time reversal because of introducing of these complex phases. This could have I, this could have minus I, so therefore there will be complex phases involved, and time reversal will be broken. So in fact, appearance of such term in the Hamiltonian would actually signal that there are actually circulating currents between the same sublattice in the Haldane's sense of this. Now, interestingly, in fact, recently it has been pointed out that such a pattern is, in fact, energetically favorable as well if you include second nearest neighbor repulsion on Hamiltonian lattice. So here I have a little phase diagram that is taken from the paper by Chu Chen Zheng's group from last year, where V1 is, let's say, repulsion between nearest neighbors on Hamiltonian lattice, and V2 is the repulsion between next nearest neighbors, so let's say these black or white dots. So if I just crank up the repulsion between nearest neighbors, then obviously I will go from this semi-metallic state where I have the fermions into staggered density, or as they call it, charge density wave, which is not very exotic possibility. But what they showed was that, in fact, if you crank up the next nearest neighbor repulsion, you will actually end up with this Haldane state that they call the, I forgot what QH was. But that's basically the better.
That's for spinless fermions?
Sorry?
That's for spinless?
This is for spinless fermions. If you include spin, then everything depends on how strong the on-site repulsion is. Whether the sense of these currents will be the same for both spins or not.
Is this a quantum anomalous Hall effect?
Yes, yes.
Obviously, it is.
Exactly.
It's true, right?
That's right. Exactly. That's what you QH stands for. But the important point is that you can, in fact, induce such a state by cranking up, let's say, artificially on the lattice next nearest neighbor repulsion.
I mean, just as a curiosity, this is all hypothetical phase diagram anyway, because you cannot change V1 and V2. And so do you have a picture of what would happen, or do you have a feel for what would happen with spin? I mean, since you're talking hypothetically, you might as well have an on-site U also.
Yes.
You probably know what it looks like. I mean, what is it?
Well, I think if you have U,
yes,
basically the state that wins in all these external interactions that you have to provide.
The usual what you'd expect.
That's right.
That's
a problem.
Yeah, okay.
So all of these, please note also, this is all in units of hopping, or maybe for Hawking even. So this is already strong interaction when any of these phases occurs. There is a large region around non-interacting point where, of course, non-interacting Dirac fermions are completely stable. It's actually a fairly liquid-like state if you don't worry about the effect of long-range part of the Coulomb interaction. So let me just mention in passing also that there are even more exotic possibilities if you have, let's say, a mass term like this. This would, in fact, on the lattice correspond to a particular arrangement of stronger bonds between nearest neighbors in the so-called Kekulé order, Kekulé pattern that was figured out by Koshanon and Moody some time ago. I don't know actually what kind of interaction would, in fact, favor such a state, but it's conceivable that there is some part of the phase diagram with these two. All of this happens by strong coupling, and we don't really worry about that much in graphene. And the reason for that, of course, is very simple. We need strong interaction, whether it's Hubbard U or nearest neighbor repulsion or anything, because there are not that many states near the Fermi level in graphene. Okay? If you introduce interaction, you want to open the gap. Of course, the most affected states are those that are near the Fermi level. And if there are not that many states, we will need quite a bit of interaction actually to open that gap. And for example, for just pure Hubbard model on honeycomb lattice, we now know that the strength of Hubbard U should be roughly 4 to 5, maybe even more, of Hawkings to actually induce anti-ferromagnetic gap. Of course, all of this because the energy density of states vanishes linearly when we approach Fermi level. So this gives you an idea of how you would actually induce such states. All you really need to do is to basically increase the density of states at the Fermi level. And one obvious way to do that, with what I already mentioned, is by putting everything in the magnetic field. This leads to lambda quantization, and in fact, you end up with a whole degenerate level at the zero energy exactly. And then depending on what your interaction actually is, and that's what I want to talk about for the rest of this talk, you will end up with some sort of mass, which you can also do as an order parameter, which once develops will actually split the zeros lambda level into two and shift all the others. So basically what you end up is that you get a new quantum Hall state at zero filling, which in fact has been observed. If you add spin, you will also get additional states at one and minus one as well. And it's already somewhat old, but it's still very interesting, at least to me. For example, if you can see here, this is a piece of that experimental diagram that I showed before, quantum Hall conductivity versus at various fittings. So you basically see at the previous line that I showed you was at lower fields where essentially there was nothing at zero, but actually at fields above roughly 15 Tesla in very clean samples. For example, Columbia group observed that there is a new state at zero, and also you see these little glitches at one and minus one that have to do probably with spin splitting. So in fact, at higher fields, and presumably higher fields are needed because of some inherent disorder which has to be overcome before anything of this becomes visible, at higher fields, there is actually a reduction of the degeneracy of the zero lambda level like this. So this is what I want to talk about, in fact. How to make a situation more favorable for the masses or the parameters that are allowed in principle to exist in there. So one thing that you can ask yourself is, already told you there are many possibilities for these masses. So how do I know which one will be actually catalyzed, if you will, this way by the magnetic field?
So let me understand. So you basically, I mean, in the language of quantum Hall physics, you want to classify the various quantum Hall ferromagnetic state, which here could be coming from the spontaneous or explicit breaking of spin or the chiral symmetry, correct?
Yes, so I'm actually neglecting spin altogether.
Yes, sir. So in your case, it's all chiral.
Not that's right. So chiral or potent, maybe time reverse.
But that's the thing that is confusing me. Because time reversal symmetry is explicitly broken. Then you think about the basically zero limit kind of?
Yes, okay. Yeah, I'll explain all that.
Good.
That's exactly good.
That's sort of my confusion was.
Yes.
Okay.
So far, I'll just have ordinary magnetic field.
Excellent.
So when I put in ordinary magnetic field, let me call that ordinary usual magnetic field vector potential. Let me put this little zero on top of it. Yeah, okay. A naught. So, if I solve the Schrödinger, sorry, Dirac equation in the magnetic field, where I explicitly break time reversal, it's easy to see what can happen. You of course get lambda levels, and you can immediately notice one thing. All of the states of the zero lambda level, in fact, will have the same eigenvalue as far as the time reversal symmetry breaking mass is concerned. And that is because when I square this Hamiltonian in C, I get the ordinary Schrödinger Hamiltonian, plus a term, basically this is just the curl of A, so this is a constant term in constant magnetic field, times some matrix, but this matrix is precisely the time reversal symmetry breaking mass. So therefore, the way I get zero energy states is basically by shifting by a certain amount states that were actually at energy one. And therefore, if they all have to be shifted to zero, they all have the same energies, the same eigenvalue of m tilde. So m tilde, in fact, is a trivial operator within the zero lambda level. It's either one or minus one, depending on what the direction of the magnetic field is. Interestingly, this is also true actually in a completely general non-uniform magnetic field, which is one thing that you can show in graphene for the Dirac equation, in fact. But otherwise, you probably cannot. And I cannot resist actually not to show you this. In fact, if you have the Hamiltonian, the Dirac Hamiltonian in a magnetic field, you can in fact write it as a transformation, which is however non-unitary, of the ordinary Hamiltonian without one. If I choose Coulomb gauge, I can actually write down the vector potential in terms of some scalar like this in two dimensions. And that is actually the scalar that comes into this exponential for this unreal function, m tilde is a Kermitian operator, but notice that there is no usual I here and here. So of course, the spectra of the Hamiltonian in and with and without magnetic field are not the same. But what this transformation tells me is that actually zero energy states are related to each other. So you see. So I can say that the zero energy states of the Hamiltonian in the magnetic field, in fact, are related to the zero energy states of the Hamiltonian without the magnetic field, times this factor here, this field. Now, if I have a localized flux, let's say some region, and let's say that amount of localized flux in units of flux is F, then I can immediately tell that actually this function chi at large S, much larger than the region where the flux is localized, is actually going to go as f log x. So that tells me that in fact all of the states in the zero energy manifold, which will exist for non-uniform magnetic fields, as long as there is some flux that penetrates the system, will all have exactly the same eigenvalue of m tilde. Because in order to be normalized, they all have to have, if this is let's say positive, m tilde has to be the minus one factor. So m tilde is a trivial operator in the zero energy manifold. But any of these chiral symmetry breaking masses, like charge density wave or Kekulé, are not. And that is because, of course, they also reduce in the zero energy manifold because they commute with the Hamiltonian. Sorry, they commute with the Hamiltonian. So any state from the zero energy manifold will be mapped into some other state in the zero energy manifold. So in other words, that's an irreducible space for all of these operators. And the trace of any of these matrices within that space is zero. And the way to see that is very simple. If I want to calculate, let's say, the trace within that zero energy manifold, so let me put a little zero here to remind me that, of let's say M1, I can calculate it by inserting, let's say, some other component m2 squared, which is just essentially 1. Because any matrix of any of these matrices squared is actually just unit matrix. So then I can use the property, the simplicity property of the case, and the fact that M1 and M2 anti-commute to actually arrive at the conclusion that this is minus space of M1. And therefore it is 0. So what does this mean? Well, this means that if I look at all my states in the zero fundamental level, I can group them into two groups. One will have eigenvalue of chosen M component, let's say gamma naught, plus one, and the others will have minus one. In fact, I can show that if I calculate the expectation value of any operator, which is traceless, such as M, the only contribution comes from the zero fundamental level, and basically it's the difference between the occupied and empty states within the zero fundamental level of this expectation value. So ultimately what we must conclude then is that something that you already know, and that is that if we break the time reversal symmetry explicitly by introduction of the magnetic field, we induce zero energy states. And these zero energy states are such that actually they will be split only by the dynamical generation of one of or the parameters that break chiral symmetry. The order parameter that does not break chiral symmetry, which is the one that contains order parameter, let me call it that way, that breaks time reversal symmetry, will not be generated because it almost only shifts the entire mental level. It doesn't split it. So the conclusion is that if the time reversal symmetry is broken explicitly, the net result of having interactions will be that the chiral symmetry will be spontaneously broken. Now, in which direction, that you cannot tell without actually in detail calculating the balance of all sorts of interactions that have there. But you can say that Haldane's order parameter will not be generated. So this is, in fact, just the ordinary story of magnetic catalysis retold in a somewhat algebraic language. So what I want to argue then is that, in fact, there is a flip coin, flip side to this one, sorry. And that is that if you have a Hamiltonian, let's say, Dirac Hamiltonian, but now not in an ordinary magnetic field that breaks time reversal, but in a pseudo-magnetic field that does not, and I can easily construct some non-abelian potential of this kind, where I would simply take some scalar functions and multiply them by the generators of the chiral symmetry, stick it into the Hamiltonian. Now this Hamiltonian actually does not have a real magnetic field, and some of you will recognize that at least one of the components, actually in the representation that I'm fond of, it will be this one here, is precisely the one that actually comes if you have a impulse in the affine, and basically it's a random pseudo-magnetic field that comes in such a situation. Essentially describes the variations of the random variations in space of the position of the Dirac point in K-space. Okay. So I can add, let's say by hand, a more general pseudo-magnetic field, non-abelian magnetic field that does not break time reversal symmetry, but of course breaks chiral symmetry. For example, if I choose, let's say, this component, right, I will break chiral symmetry in certain sense. I will break, for example, gamma 3 and gamma 5 generators, but I will not break gamma 35. So if we introduce a non-abelian magnetic field like this, then what we have is that actually exact opposite of the situation that I just described will be realized. In other words, in that case, the Haldane's order parameter, M tilde, is the one that still undercommutes with the Hamiltonian, and therefore gets reduced in the zero fundamental level. But now, actually, in the zero fundamental level, because time reversal is also the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and therefore commutes with the Hamiltonian, which was not the case before, I can look at, within that Hilbert space, at M tilde and time reversal operator, And this M tilde actually breaks time reversal. That precisely means that the content commutes with the time reversal operator. So therefore, I can write down trace of M tilde and then use the only anti-commuting operator I have in that Hilbert space, which is the time reversal operator, to actually construct the exact analog of this argument here to say that trace of M tilde within that Hilbert space is actually zero. So what that means is that if I now look at the zero energy states, and again, there will be zero energy states, doesn't matter that this is not a real magnetic field, one can actually use the very general theorems of T.S. Singer and the others who actually translated it into this language to show that there are zero energy states, as long as there is any flux, uniform or not. Within that subspace, it will now be the Haldane's operator that in fact has half of each states with a positive energy plus one and half of the states with an eigenvalue minus one. So what that means is that if I now have any sort of favorable interaction, and we know that there is actually one from the work of Radu, Chuchenzheng and others, that is the next nearest neighbor repulsion, we come to the conclusion that if the chiral symmetry is therefore broken explicitly by introducing such a non-abelian magnetic field, the net effect of the interaction will actually be the breaking of the time reversal of the time reversal symmetry to the generation of the Haldane's gas. So this is the logic of something that I would call the pseudomagnetic catalysis. If we have a flux of non-abelian pseudomagnetic field, right, so I'm looking at this completely formally, but you can think of this flux essentially as, let's say, height deformation somewhere in SEM. As shown by several people, in fact, height variations translate into precisely the component of such a general non-abelian magnetic field. In fact, in my language, it would be actually this 35. So if you have a bump, let's say, somewhere, you would, in fact, as far as the electrons, the flow energies are concerned, introduce flux of the pseudomagnetic field, and possibly something else as well, but at least this. So such a flux, then, would actually lead to a subspace of zero energy states, which, of course, if the flux is localized, will not be actually separated by a gap from the other states in the spectrum, as they are in the case of the uniform magnetic field. But they would still exist, right? That's this famous theorem that goes back to Arcadian Singer. So my point is that actually having these states now makes the situation favorable for the formation of the time reversal symmetry breaking mass in case of some general repulsive interaction, which of course will actually contain, let's say, next nearest neighbor component, simply because of the algebra of these operators within that subspace. So we come to the exact opposite of the usual magnetic catalysis. Right? We break by introducing such a, let's say, bump in the graphene, we break, at least locally, chiral symmetry, but actually the net effect due to interaction then is that the time reversal symmetry gets continuously broken. So of course, in the quantum Hall effect, we have a uniform magnetic field, and it's easy to impose uniform magnetic field. It's not so easy to impose uniform non-abelian magnetic field that would come from some height variation. So therefore, the real problem would be if you have, let's say, just a localized bump, and otherwise flat sheet of graphene, you would actually have locally a flux of non-abelian field. Nevertheless, what one can show, in fact, more or less numerically, although one can make some analytical arguments, is that even if you have, let's say, a non-uniform pseudo-magnetic field, or magnetic field as well, you will actually, to solve these equations, end up again with finite order parameter, which more or less will be localized in the region where the flux is localized. So, I'm getting ahead of time a little bit, I think. So one point that I try to convey is that, in fact, the Dirac Hamiltonian, one of its most beautiful features is that it actually has a plenty of emergent symmetry, which one can use for various purposes. And for the purposes of this talk, I focus on the role of chiral symmetry in time reversal. which together, in fact, allow for a whole variety of different not insulating phases, which we can also call Higgs phases, because these are precise analogs of Higgs, except that Higgs, in this case, would be a composite object, of course, made out of the original electrons. Now, we don't ordinarily see these mod phases being obtained that easily, because interactions actually need to be rather strong for this to happen because of the zero density states, if there is no field present. But one way to actually turn the tide in favor of Higgs physics is to actually put this in the magnetic field, or pseudo-magnetic field, because in both of these situations, through the Athias singular-like theorems, there are zero energy states which basically form an autonomous closed Hilbert space for all of these order parameters, which are essentially matrices operators in this space. And then one can simply, from algebra of these matrices, actually tell in advance, without doing any calculation, which order parameter can and cannot be catalyzed in presence of interactions when one has zero energy states present. So most importantly, I would say that, in fact, non-linear magnetic flux, in principle, tends to catalyze time and symmetry breaking. So one experimental consequence of this would, in fact, be that if you would, let's say, deliberately make a bump in the affine, so some localized height variation in the curvature, and therefore that way introduce the one of these three components of the non-Abelian magnetic field, actual interactions would locally form the time-reversal symmetry breaking mass for this Haldane's order parameter. So I'll thank you for your attention.
Questions for you?
Yes.
Let's
ask you. Going to the last point, still, if the interactions were dominated by some strong on-site repulsion, you will get spin density waves or not?
No, in fact, that's the thing. See.
Why?
Because you see, so strong on-site repulsion, in fact, like to produce rotation value for gamma naught, basically. But gamma naught within the subspace of the zero energy states actually is a unity operator. So if you try to solve the self-consistent equation for that order parameter in presence of non-Abelian flux, there will be no non-trivial solution. Because you see, what you need to have is that if you have zero energy states, that this order parameter actually pushes half of the states up and half of them down. So if your chemical potential is in the middle, you see, you end up with a finite order time. Yeah. But what gamma naught does, in fact, it actually pushes them all up or down.
So if you it will push up the ones from one valley and down the ones from the other valley.
That's exactly the point. That will not happen. That's exactly, you see, why in the original catalysis, you see, in the original catalysis, you know in advance that Haldane's order parameter will never get generated. You see, you may say, okay, let me imagine that I have some very strong next nearest neighbor repulsion. Now let me try to solve some of the equations for the Haldane's order parameter in presence of ordinary magnetic field. The only solution of that equation will be zero. And that is precisely because if this were to develop, it would actually never split the Lambda level for the zero energy manifold. It would only push it up or down. So you cannot satisfy the self-consistent product. So this is exactly the selection rule, you see, that in the presence of ordinary magnetic field, time reversal symmetry breaking masses are selected, and Haldane's mass is forbidden. And vice versa, if you have pseudo-magnetic field.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand something. Why would sigma x bar be zero when you open a gap at the zero energy state?
Sigma x, y, huh? Yes, yeah, so your chemical potential is precisely here.
So why would it be
so the impact is zero. It actually,
why would you see a plateau?
You see a plateau, you see, because now if you move the chemical potential, you have actually some energy region where you can move it and not change the impact.
It's because of particle hole symmetry, basically. It's particle hole symmetry.
That's right. But you need to split the,
yeah, exactly,
the level to actually get the
space. You need to split. Yes, you need to split them, right? Because you cannot decide what the sign of the Hall effect is.
Okay, so it's not the edge curve. Okay.
Intuitively, can I understand your non-abelian flux as actually ordinary flux that is pointing opposite direction for,
yes,
the two valleys?
That's right. That would be one of these components, precisely.
Gamma's three, I guess.
Yes, you see. So this is precisely that matrix. So it's, let's say, plus for the one valley and minus for the other valley.
Yeah.
But of course, the
combination,
even more general statement is true, but I don't know what the more general statement is.
So you probably just need to mix up the value in some specific way to,
yeah,
get two combinations, and one is up and the other is down, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. Basically, what you need is to kind of see the most general potential we can put in here is basically a linear combination of the generators, gamma 3, gamma 5, gamma 35, and unit matrix.
Right.
So unit matrix gives you the ordinary real magnetic field. The rest gives you this pseudo magnetic field that does not break diversity.
So one of the predictions, if you have a bump, then local time reversal symmetry is broken.
That's right.
So are you saying if I have a light and I shine a light into the spot, then I will have a rotation of a car angle?
For that's
example?
Right. That's what I would
that's
expect.
That's experimental, yeah, prediction?
That would be a prediction, that's right.
Okay.
Walk up though.
Walk up,
yeah.
Walk up. Yeah, where the light is going through in graphene.
Yes.
That, I mean, you can make lights pretty large.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, that's easy to check.
I would imagine. I don't know how easy it would be, but in principle, I think it is quite doable.
I had a small question. So if you now include real spin, wouldn't you have to worry about your non-abelian gauge potential induced chiral symmetry breaking, which is continuous because you're really breaking just the time reversal invariance. Wouldn't that compete with the just breaking of the regular SU2 symmetry of spin due to Coulomb interaction or something like that? Meaning, experimentally, I see a lifting of the zero, and I see one, okay,
yes,
which is normally not allowed, right?
Yes.
And in the pedestrian language, without using any of the algebra used, I look at that and I say, well, I understand what is going on. I have originally an SU4 system because I have two spin and two valleys, and that's lifted somehow. And how it's lifted depends on whatever infinitesimal,
yes,
you know, this is spontaneous symmetry. It could be spin, it could be valley, doesn't,
yes,
matter. They're all in the language of quantum Hall effect, quantum Hall effect.
Yes.
How would that fit in here? I mean, you are just considering only half of that story because you just had the valleys.
That's
right.
Yes, yes. There is another half.
Right.
So you see, yeah,
I mean, I'm asking a very simple question.
Yes,
I mean,
yes, I know what you're asking. So you see, let's say I have a real spin as well.
Right.
Then in fact, let's look at the absolutely simplest possible
right
model we can have, which is the Hubbard model. So if you just one side view,
mm-hmm,
real spin included.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I looked at that some time ago, and there is an actually interesting result. If you're exactly at half field, then the Hartree-Fock solution for that problem is the following. If you don't have any Zeeman coupling, let's say that you turn,
yes,
off that,
yes, no explicit symmetry breaking at
then
all.
Then the ground state, in fact,
mm-hmm,
is the ground state is a nail ordered antiferromagnet with the nail vector being orthogonal to the magnetic field. Okay? It's not that difficult to imagine. If you, however, turn on, let's say gradually in your mind, the same coupling, then you, of course, have this Kuhn state, essentially, compete.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it wins if the Zeeman coupling is large enough. So there's a competition between these two states.
But
and it's in general, too.
Yeah, but this
is always a competition between Kuhn's like physics and this kind of
symmetry. I accept what you're saying, but I'm afraid that's a feature of using Hubbard model. In real,
yes,
system of Coulomb interaction, I have no doubt that what would be is a ferromagnetic state, not an antiferromagnetic state, for Coulomb interaction. You see what I'm saying? In the Hubbard model, you're getting an antiferromagnetic, right? I mean,
mm-hmm,
if I have Coulomb interaction, I have spin, I usually do not get regular long-range Coulomb interaction. I do not get an antiferromagnetic state.
Yes.
Hartree Fock certainly gives me a ferromagnetic state for any density. So that would be a bit different. But you, of course, left out the long-range Coulomb interaction completely, right?
You mean due to the long-range
right.
tail.
Okay.
Yes. I'll add that.
And that would look a little bit like this. But it's very interesting. Other questions or comments?
There is that competition always. You see,
oh, that,
I just want to point out,
sure,
there is an additional competition, which is...
No, I was not trying to point out problem in your theory, just trying to understand
yes,
it. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, but that competition is there, it's just a fact of life, you know.
That's right.
Other questions under comments? Well, if not, let's thank Igor for giving a very nice talk. Even the last talk on Friday afternoon had within a factor of two exactly.